Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Poet, essayist, and novelist Ray Youngbear has been writing and publishing for half a century now. And right now he's having a bit of a moment with new poetry featured in the Iowa Review. That's coming out in just a couple of days, a new anthology on the way from Tupelo Press, and the publication of a new essay in which he looks back on his discovery of poetry and how he found his voice as a writer and as a member of the Meskwaki Nation. Throughout his career, he's been dedicated to preserving Meskwaki language and traditions, and he's in the studio with me today. Ray Youngbear, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Charity, for having me today. It's always good to make the pilgrimage to Iowa City. As you know, I was here in 1971 briefly, and then on and off over the years doing poetry readings and whatnot.
Yeah, well, speaking of the 1970s, your essay, The Summer of 1969, Children of Speak Thunder, is going to be published in Native Voices, Indigenous American Poetry, Craft, and Conversations. And let's go back in time to the 1960s. I know that as a child, you spoke Meskwaki, so you came to English as a second language, right?
Yes. I think my grandmother's stance was early on that education would eventually take from Meskwaki culture. And so I would view the yellow bus that I got on every morning as a nemesis or an adversary type situation. However, as the years went on, my grandmother became relaxed in her stance and eventually said that I would have to make use of the English language and do the best I can to communicate things that the greater world didn't understand as much as I could. And so that's how that worked out.
Do you remember when you really first discovered what poetry was?
I remember things like lullabies, and I think at one point in fourth grade we had a Native American teacher, a Sioux woman teacher from South Dakota, who taught us, I believe it's Lochinvar, an old story set in a poetic format. And that is what I was thinking in seventh grade when an English teacher came up to me after I had submitted an essay that I thought I had done well on. However, she came up to me and said, "Ray, do you know what you have done?" And I said, "No." She says, "You have written a poem." And the word lingered in my mind for most of the week, wondering what that was. And then I just remembered bits and pieces of what I had been taught in at All Indian School. And so that's how that started. And I wanted to write an essay. However, I had written a poem, and I wasn't sure whether I had flunked or whether I had, you know, whether she would be...
You'd done better than the essay.
Or whether she had been somewhat reticent in her divulgence of the paper itself. Maybe I did well. And then she, for whatever reason, didn't appreciate the fact that I was doing this. So, you know, I fictionalized this whole interaction with the teacher because it's pivotal. On the one hand, I took off on it to try and make a better essay, at the same time using poetry as a stepping stone to get myself to fiction and eventually nonfiction. So it worked out eventually.
Yeah. Well, as time went on and you were writing poetry, you got noticed for writing poetry and invited to a writer's workshop in Bemidji.
Yes, that's correct. I think in 1968, I wrote a poem. It was an assignment in Upper Bound in Decorah, Iowa, wherein we were supposed to write about our campus experience. And I didn't want to write an essay type situation again, so I took a shortcut, or I got lazy, let's say, and I wrote a poem. The poem attracted attention of some of the Upper Bound teachers, and so one thing led to another. They promoted it, they published it in Idea Exchange, which was Upper Bound national publication that was seen by somebody else. Eventually, I made it to Bemidji that year in 1969 and went to a writer's workshop. And it was there that I was exposed to the likes of Robert Bly, David Ray, William Stafford, Vance Borzelli, who I believe was the director of the Iowa Writers' Workshop here at that time or something to that regard, and a number of other writers that influenced me greatly, but no one more than James Welch, who was a Blackfeet writer. And he was introduced to me by Robert Bly. And so I thought on that day that the whole quest to be a poet ended right there, because James Welch was superb. And I was 18 reading his work. He was 10 years older, but I thought, I'm done for.
You thought this is perfect. It had been done.
Yeah, but then I was forever trying to emulate. And, you know, James became a friend of mine eventually, but he passed away years ago. And so James Welch is the focus of this essay.
What do you think it meant to you to read the work of a native poet when you were 18 years old? Had you encountered anything like that before?
I thought there was, at that time, I thought it was novel. It was interesting. I thought, how neat that you could be a Native American and be published in a nice little paperback, a nice little hefty one. And I thought, one of these days, I'm going to do that same thing myself. And lo and behold,
you have done
it. Yeah, I got that and some other ones. It was six books total. Three more to go. You know, those are my aspirations.
Well, and I think about the young Native people today picking up your work, seeing your work, and having that same feeling that you had the first time you read a poem by James Welch. Do you ever think about that?
No, I don't. And it must be hard because you have to go through an entire regimen of creativity. And if you're bilingual and if you're bicultural, there are other things in there where you have to throw it in and hopefully have that dovetail in with popular American culture and have something come out of that. So it's tough.
Well, and you were writing in English. Most of your work has been published in English, although, as you mentioned, that was a second language for you. But you've also been so dedicated to preserving the language and preserving the culture of the Meskwaki people. And it feels like in recent years, you've had a little more freedom to publish in Meskwaki and share that more broadly. In fact, you performed a song for The New Yorker. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, we received, those who have published in The New Yorker before, received an email from The New Yorker basically saying, we are in the process of changing editors. This editor will be here for a while. We're requesting if you want to submit something, you're welcome to do it now. I think I had about 1 month leeway. They had already rejected a group of poems maybe about 6 to 8 months previously, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And so one morning I went on my porch and saw some fireflies, and they seemed to make, it was probably coincidence, a spherical, a ball shape, into a ball shape. They clustered into kind of like a sphere, and that was amazing to me. It could have been just coincidence, but I eventually wrote a song out of it. The lyrics in English are, it is almost daylight, I said to the firefly, for the last time, illuminate yourself. For the last time, illuminate yourself. That's the English version, but the actual creation of the poem began with the song itself when I was sitting on a porch. And the song, I'll sing it one verse through, and this is where the Meskwaki language is implemented, and I hope I can remember this song. It's just nervous today. So I sent that off, and lo and behold, within a week, I believe it was accepted.
Nice.
And so
that's beautiful.
You know, knocked me out of my socks entirely. And there's another song also. But that one was, it was spontaneous and it was made. The other song was about milkweed, just walking down the road of our driveway, and then I smelled what smelled like sweet flowers, and I thought, wow, those are nice. But it turned out to be milkweeds, and I dedicated a song for them, how I mistook them for flowers, but lo and behold, they were milkweeds. So those two got accepted, and I couldn't have been happier on that day.
What do you feel right now? I mean, you've been through so much in your life as a Meskwaki man. I mean, you went from those early days where you felt like the school bus was taking you away from mm-hmm. your culture. And of course, there was a real fight for Native pride in the 1970s when you were becoming a writer and, mm-hmm. and getting noticed. How do you feel about what it means to be a Native man in the United States now, in 2019?
It's very interesting because there are so many requirements facing not only Native Americans, but also Americans in general. And in Native American society, one of the things that is happening currently is the push for linguistic preservation. And in the back of my mind, when I'm writing in Meskwaki, I just think, well, in the long run, at some point, my work will be researched and studied. And I think that's the whole purpose of why I'm circling back to the linguistic roots, going back to Meskwaki, and then writing the text out in Meskwaki as best I can, writing brief narratives for starters, then, but, you know, the song process started it. But eventually, I like to do a whole essay in the Meskwaki language and short stories. So that's a goal. It's a hard one. It's probably more complicated than doing a novel. But, you know, if I've written a novel, hopefully I can do something in Meskwaki.
It sounds like you're very aware of what you're leaving for posterity. Do you think about that as you're writing this? Do you think about the future generations of Meskwaki and having
read? It motivates me when I see young students attempting to learn their language because it's commendable. They're facing a humongous challenge through American civilization that pretty much requires them to be fully attuned with academia because the world thrives on English language. There's math involved, there's history involved, and all of those things you have to keep yourself well-versed on. At the same time, you have your parents and your grandparents attempting to make you aware of your cultural roots, and, you know, it makes you more conscious about one's work and how it's going to help those who are having a hard time. And so hopefully some of these songs that I am releasing now will help these young children get motivated so that they in turn are able to create their own music and preserve in their own way the Meskwaki language.
Before we run out of time, would you read one of the poems that will be appearing in the Iowa Review?
The Iowa Review has been very, very friendly over the years. It'll be my third appearance. I think the first one, 2006, and then 2008, and then this year. But this one is kind of like I call it my Mad Max theme tune, poem. And you may get it as you go. It's kind of like futuristic at the same time it's not. It's called The Loneliest Bird, and this takes off from a headline I saw on CNN. I believe it says, "The loneliest bird in the world dies." And I started reading about it, how they had isolated one bird and took him to a line and hopefully with other birds, but everybody left, and so he was the only one there. And they put concrete birds there, and eventually he died But anyway, it's for him. And so, The Loneliest Bird. Forced by a fatal contagion, Akuma Damuan, to wake early and drive 40 miles round trip for family necessities, the night driving clip-ons are attached and Shimog scarf is coiled to neck. In a World War II desert half-track that was jump-started at 15 below zero, we trundle over the hinterland before sunrise. Verily, upon returning and with PC scrolling online news, Adam, herbal supplement doesn't placate the world because Natalie Wood has yet to sip an aperitif called Eternal Rest. After reading about the loneliest bird in the world dying, I shudder internally for the rest of the day. This survivalist quest will be repeated before my third AIDS-related surgery Tuesday. Yes, man and nature aren't foes, but when the sick also seek the same food and detergent, the vortex is no longer endemic. It's therefore imperative to take a family portrait today. Me, a pensive bullfrog, the third oldest elder of Gishko Creek, sitting beside turning eagle wings glint, my companion in her appliqué dress, with Kind Bear, our son, standing behind us in his beaded dance regalia and speckled feathers. As a poet in Sunday's best, an Osage-style otter turban with silver medallions will serve as a crown. Through these thick sunglasses, my eyes will also convey all that's been achieved, a history of literary mediocrity with a P.S. in bold font that I remain bilingual and therefore steadfast, a fabulous testament against colonialism then and now.
Ray Youngbear, I'm so glad that you came in to see us today, and I can't wait to read your future work. Congratulations on all the publications in the coming month. That's
fantastic.
Thank
you for bringing me on a whirlwind trip to Iowa City. And Caitlin, thank you too, and your radio station.
I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Poet, essayist, and novelist Ray Youngbear. He is publishing a new poem in the Iowa Review. He has a new anthology on the way from Tupelo Press. And his new essay, The Summer of 1969, Children of Speak Thunder, will be published in Native Voices, Indigenous American Poetry, Craft, and Conversations. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Dennis Reese. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, at Iowa Public Radio. I'm there as well, at Charity Nebbe. And subscribe to our podcast. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.